Good evening and welcome to the David Shaler Show. Obviously, it's not David Shaler speaking tonight unless he's wearing very tight trousers. I'm Annie Machon. I'm covering for him tonight. He's unavoidably detained, not at Majesty's pleasure for a change, but with his family. Tonight we have a great treat because we have a very special guest who's going to come in and talk about his experiences which he lived through on 9/11. But first of all, of course, David normally looks at some of the news that's been in the headlines this week. And the one that, of course, stands out at me is the Litvinenko case, which seems to be running and running. And I have to say, this is just an absolutely amazing case for us to be watching, because, of course, it's a mirror image of what David went through from the reverse side. In this case, we have a whistleblower from the FSB, which, of course, is the new name for the KGB, who came out and went on the run and said that the KGB, FSB, had voluntarily gone ahead and blown up some apartments in Moscow. This was back in the late 1990s. In these attacks, 300 people died. They were innocent victims of state-sponsored terrorism. And the reason we know it's state-sponsored terrorism is down to the courage of this one whistleblower. And the reason the KGB did this was because they wanted a pretext to go into a war in Chechnya, which is still going on. And it's just an appalling abuse of human rights, appalling loss of life, and it's really going back to the bad old days of the Soviet Cold War. But the whole Litvinenko thing is interesting from another point of view as well, because everyone's speculating about how he died, what he died from, but nobody really seems to be looking at who really has killed him, whether it's the FSB, who might be operating on behalf of Putin and the regime, or whether it's rogue elements of the FSB working to a completely different agenda, perhaps something like the New World Order. I doubt if we'll ever get to the bottom of. But do watch this space, because it's something that is worth investigating. And as I said on a number of platforms this week, it's also part of a greater theme that's running through modern politics. Things like state-sponsored terrorism are part of the arsenal of the intelligence services and the government, and they use it without any concern for human life. So we're looking at a case of not only the death of Litvinenko, the whistleblower, but also the persecution of someone brave like David Shaler, who blew the whistle on the plot to kill Colonel Gaddafi of Libya back in 1996. And in this case, of course, the attack went wrong. Gaddafi is now very much a new best friend of the Western leaders. But that attack was funded by MI6. So yet another state-sponsored false flag terrorist attack. This happens again and again, and all I would say to you is, next time there's a big terrorist atrocity, have a look behind the headlines and try and work out what's really going on. Anyway, enough of that. Tonight we'd like to, very great pleasure, it's a great privilege, to introduce my guest, very brave man, a very remarkable man, and also a decorated US hero, and also one of the leading truth campaigners in the world. This is a man who has survived 9/11. He was the last man out of the towers before they collapsed. William Rodriguez, welcome very much tonight.
Thank you for that presentation. I feel like a coffee cake when they put the syrup on top. Really, really kind of embarrassed. It's been an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to have spent a whole week with you and David Shaler, and especially now that David for me always was one of my heroes, and to meet him and finally spend some time just spreading the truth about what happened on 9/11 really have made this more significant to my campaign. Thank you.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, of course, you came over to attend a peace conference at the weekend organized by the Islam Channel. I gather there was about 50,000 people at that conference. It was called Global Peace and Unity. And you personally addressed about 22,000 people in the hall.
Yeah, that is correct. It was by far the largest audience I have ever presented myself to live. And because through television, I have been able to reach over 500 million people on one single day. But the life itself, this was just a life-changing experience for me.
It was incredible, And you very kindly agreed to stay on for next week and do a tour around the UK.
Yes, correct. And thanks to you, I was able to go through the different venues that we have here in the nation that really wants to hear what really happened on that day.
I have to say, I mean, the 9/11 Truth campaign in the UK is taking off so rapidly.
Yes, they
There's have. A great awareness. There's a great suspicion of what the government's the intelligence services get up to,
and but I feel embarrassed to talk about that myself. Why don't you tell them about what happened on those venues? Because, you know, it's easier for you to say than for me to.
I am very happy to. The campaign has a number of groups just popping up across the country, and they've literally fought over who would have the pleasure of hosting William Rodriguez this week. And we've done a number of speeches, one down in the southwest in Torquay, a big one to a bunch of journalists in Bristol, up in Yorkshire as well, in Skipton, where there's a very thriving group, and of course a couple of very big meetings in London. And the reception was amazing. As I said, there's this awareness, I think, this growing awareness of the 9/11 Truth Campaign. But to hear your personal story about what went on that day and why you personally are convinced about 9/11 being an inside job, there is no describing it. It was just wonderful. It really was.
An experience by itself. For me, actually, to speak directly to the people and to be mingling with the hunger for information that was out there, because everybody wanted to know. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to hear why, yeah, on what happened, on the issues affecting the victims of 9/11 right now, 5 years after. Right now, the problems that they have used 9/11 to create an international world agenda to basically curtail all the rights of everybody. So basically, to hear the story, the personal experience of the last survivor of the World Trade Center on that day has been beneficial, not only for them, but for me to actually have this kind of relationship and meeting so many people of so many different walks of life.
Well, this is the amazing thing about the 9/11 Truth Campaign in the UK. I mean, it's every age, every class, every political persuasion. It's just the thing that unites us is that we don't want to be lied to anymore by the governments, particularly when those lies are used to take us into illegal wars in the Middle East, where people are killed on a daily basis. I think we're looking at an estimate of 650,000 people have died in Iraq so far. And, of course, as you mentioned before, the erosion of all our traditional freedoms and our civil liberties. I mean, the governments are just taking the piss, to be quite honest, aren't they?
Correct.
That's lovely. Perhaps we should just segue into a bit of your story now, because I'm sure the listeners are dying to hear.
Okay, I'm the last survivor of the World Trade Center, the person that worked there for 20 years. I was a janitor, a caretaker for the whole stairwells of the North Tower. I was also a person instrumental on the creation of the 9/11 commission that was created to investigate the events. I was decorated as a national hero. I was sent to train for politics at the Governing Institute, and also became the family leader and the activist when I found out that my story was being manipulated and actually omitted from the final report of the commission. That's when we started to go all over the world to bring this information so people will understand that prior the plane hitting the tower, there was a huge explosion on the basement and many explosions as we went up that actually corroborate the version that there was a controlled demolition that brought the towers down. I was located on the basement at 8 o'clock in the morning. Actually, I'm sorry, 8:30 in the morning on that day. I came in late. I was the basement number one. The building has 6 up levels. And while I was there, we heard a huge explosion.
Now, don't take my word for it. Anything that I'm going to tell you right now is out there, because we said it on 9/11. Not only me, the firemen, first responders, and victims that came out of the building. Now, we hear that impact on the top, and everybody started screaming, the 14 people in general in the office, and all of a sudden we hear a person coming like this with the hands extended saying, "Explosion, explosion!" And when I looked at him, he has all the skin pulled from under his armpits, all the way to the top of the fingertips, and he was hanging like he was a piece of glove. When you take off a glove and let it hang it, exactly like that. I thought it was clothing when I realized it was his skin. When I finally look at his face, he got missing parts on his face. I said, "What happened?" He was in shock. He said, "The elevators." I said, I don't understand. So I went to pick up, don't move, I went to pick up the phone to call the EMS unit that was located on the South Tower, and when I go to pick up the phone, another explosion on the top, and the walls cracked more, and everything started to shake. So I said, we gotta get out. I took the guy, it was a black guy named Felipe David, that's Felipe, and I let everybody out. We went out through the loading dock, we get outside, there's an ambulance coming over. We stopped the ambulance. I put Mr. Felipe David, a guy from Bolivia, who was on the B2 level, was in charge of filling up the machines with water in the building, the vending machines, and with sodas. And as he was in his room, in his closet, he said there was fire, and he put his hands to cover his face because of the huge explosion. And that's how he made it. He tried to make it through the elevator, and he couldn't make it. So he went up the stairwells, one flight up, and that's how he went to my office. So I took him out, put him in the ambulance. He goes into a coma in the ambulance. There's one I hear for the first time. A plane hit the building. A security guard was standing right next to me with a radio, and that's when I look up for the first time, and I see the hole, the debris coming down, the fire. But from the angle of vision that I had, because I was right at the corner of the base of the building, you couldn't see the antenna. So I went crazy. I said, we got to go up, because I thought right away of the people from Windows of the World. He said, we got to go up. And those 14 people that I took out, they started, no, you stay here. My supervisor, a guy three times my size, weightlifter, it was Rodriguez, you're not going in there. You stay here. He said, no, we're going in. No, you stay here. So I took the radio from the security guard, who I knew, and I ran inside the building through the loading dock, down the hill, went inside, and there was water all over. Now, water all over on the basement. How come there wasn't water on the top floors? Again, an explosion on the basement. Now, I get to the South Tower, because after the 1993 bombing, they created something called the OCC, of the Operation Control Center, on the South Tower. They spent $153 million to retrofit the building. And so I wanted to tell them that I had a person that was wounded outside the building. So when I get there, there's nobody in the office. I'm hitting the bulletproof window. Nobody answers. I found a guy called Jimmy Barrett that worked for the maintenance company, who was on the lower basement from the South Tower, who did not know what was going on. He was, what's happening? And I told him what I heard and what I heard on the radio. And he couldn't believe it. So that gives you an idea of how many people probably died on the sub-levels without knowing ever what was going on. Now, I told him, you got to get out. There was a lady at the entrance to the Marriott Hotel on the basement that heard the whole thing, but did not dare to leave her post because she was a new worker and she was afraid that she was going to be fired. I said, you got to get out now. She said, no, I'm new. Get out now. There's nobody here. As I left the South Tower, I ran again towards the North Tower. When I get to the North Tower, I found only one person, a guy in charge of the recycling company, who tells me, I hear screams. But the sound of the sprinkler system did not allow you to really hear well. Because, you know, the shh sound. So I put my ear in one of the freight elevators. There were 150 elevators in the whole complex. And I hear two people trapped in between B2 level and the B3 level. Now, these two people, one of them was Salvatore Giambanco, a person that worked as a painter for the Port Authority and a delivery guy. And he was saying, we're going to drown. So that didn't make any sense. How this person is going to drown? All the water from the sprinkler systems all over was going down the elevator shaft. And since the elevator lost power, they got encapsulated. And you know how the freight elevators are? That it has, it's not a regular roof, it's just a mesh. That's exactly because all the water was going very easily in. So I said, God, please help me. I was not a spiritual person. I was not. And at that moment, I found in an area that was supposed to be clean of any construction debris, a huge metal pipe. I took that pipe, put it against the door, forced the door open, and when it opened up, The door is open this way because it's a freight elevator. Ambient music. There you go. When the door is open, I'm sorry. When the door is open, the bottom door, when it gets to the bottom, makes all the water on my side to rush in with more power. Now I look, there's no elevator. The shaft is empty by itself because the elevator is down. When I peek down, I see way below these two people standing on a wood log with water up to here. I said, "Oh my God, what is this?" I'm still not comprehending what's going on. And I said, "God, help me." Again. Because they're screaming, "Help, help, help, help," and looking up. You see these eyes practically coming out of their faces. And I didn't know how to get down there. So when I said, "God, please help me," I remember right away that in the area where they have the trash compactors, the electricians always had ladders, but they always tied them up with chains so people would not steal them, because it was easy to come inside the loading dock with the truck, put a ladder inside, and take it. So they always tied them up with chains. So I said, "Let me find one. Please, let me find one." And I ran there. And the incredible thing is that the only one that was not chained was the longest one of all the ladders. An 18 feet long ladder, which I took, aluminum ladder, I took it, dropped it inside the elevator shaft, went inside, opened the grid, got them both out, took them outside the building, put them in an ambulance, and went back inside the building, again through the loading dock running. Because my concern again was how to help the people of Windows of the World. And I'm like, "My friends, my God, my friends," and I'm screaming, "We gotta go back in." Nobody wanted to go in. So I said, "I'm going again." So I went in and I found police officer David Lim from the Port Authority Police. He was in charge of the K-9 unit. He meets me there, he said, "Willie," and stays quiet. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "Do you have the key?" I said, "Yes." He meant, did I have the key, the master key? There were only 5 master keys in the building. The people with the other 4 were trained on egress, escape, rescue efforts, and they were the first one to run out. Yeah. I was just a janitor. And the reason that I had that key was because I sued the Port Authority in 1997 because I fell down the stairwells and they couldn't find me for like 3 hours. And I won the arbitration and they had to give me the key. And that key opened the whole complex. So of course, the Port Authority police knew, because it was a high security level key, that I had it. So I said, "Let's go." We get to the lobby. Now, all the firemen are there waiting with something called the fire access key, which is a key that they put in any elevator. And if the elevator is up, we'll go down. If it's down, we'll go up to pick them up. So, they are waiting for the elevator. I said, "Forget about the elevator. There's no elevator. Follow me. I know the best way. And I have the key to the stairwells. Follow me." So this whole unit, ladder 6, follows me as we start going up the stairwells. Now, it was so difficult because these poor people, talking about the firemen, they have so much equipment in their back. We're talking about 70 to 150 pounds of equipment between machines to open doors, machine to break things, you know. It was so hard to go up because people were coming down and kept bumping into us. The stairwells were, we only had three stairwells, A, B, and C. B was the longest one of them. And as we make it over there to the third floor, we have to stop and regroup because it was so difficult. So I said, let's go by the A staircase, which was the one that faced the area that the building was hit by the plane. So we start going up, and now we start the odyssey. We have to go and open every single door. Now, I'm going to tell you why. The World Trade Center was a Class A building. For anybody in construction here, will understand that Class A building means that three doors won't open, one will open. Three won't open, one will open all the way to the top. The reason they do that is because it's a skyscraper over, I think, 27 floors high. They have to have that safety to encapsulate a fire, because otherwise a fire will consume a building going up, the fire. So they do that. They will sacrifice maybe a floor or two, but everybody else will be safe. So that's why opening those doors was crucial. I want to show you the... These are the stairwells. It's not big. Look at that. No re-entry. Next re-entry, 43 and 39 floor. Huh. The problem was that the World Trade Center was such a tall building, a city within a city, that a lot of people, the turnaround was constant. People getting fired, people getting hired, people retiring, was a constant. So, a lot of people didn't even know where the exits were. They made drills only two times a year. They should have had mandatory drills so people will know every time that they will go to work for the first time where to escape. They didn't have that. That's one of the recommendations that we made to the National Institute on Safety and Technology. Now, we start going up, and it was so hard because these poor people couldn't continue at the same pace as I was going. I had no equipment in my bag. I have no fireproof clothing that made it difficult. I had just my uniform, and I did the stairwells every single day. So physically, at that time, I was very skinny. Very, very skinny. I was sometimes two or three floors above the fire department, opening doors, going in the offices, screaming for people to follow my voice, letting people out. As I went up, we heard explosions on the third zone. The third zone is from 44 to 1. You have 110 to 78, 78 to 44, 44 to 1. The building was divided that way. When I asked, what are those explosions? And he said, oh, maybe the gas tanks in the kitchens. It was a Class A building. Only electrical kitchens are allowed. Right? The smell was horrible. Was putrid. Was, imagine ammonia and sulfur getting stuck in your throat. That's exactly how it smelled over there. And shocking moment was that a person comes down and said, we have a person on a wheelchair on the 27th floor that cannot breathe. I go down two flights below and I tell the fire department, they told me that they have a person on a wheelchair. What can we do? He said, don't worry, we'll make it there. And he explained, we always leave the handicaps for the last, so they will not impede the rescue of the majority of the people. So we always leave them for the last. But we'll make it over there. But the thing is that we actually made it to the 27th floor. When we made it to the 27th floor, all that group of firemen, all of them, collapsed on the corridor because physically they could not continue going up the stairwells. They didn't have the stamina. They didn't have power. They just took their jackets, their equipment, they dropped it on the floor. And I remember that some of them even took their boots and they laid down. And it was so sad just to see that. And David Lim tells me, the police officer, Willie, do you know this floor? I say, yeah. I say, where can we get water? He said, well, there's a machine, a vending machine on the other side. So let's go. He breaks the machine. We start taking the water, putting them in trash cans. And we distribute them to the firemen. I get the opportunity, because there was power in there, to pick up a phone and call my mother. I wanted to call my mother in Puerto Rico to let her know that I was okay in case she heard something. Little did I know, was that everybody knew what was happening but us. She picked up the phone and said, what are you doing? Get out of there. I said, Mom, I'm okay. Nothing has happened to me. There's an accident here. And I'm helping the fire department. He said, that's not your job. Get out. I say, Ma, I have the key. These people don't know what they're doing. They don't know the building. Because there was total disorientation. Everybody was doing something different. Nobody knew what was going on. Chain of command over there didn't work. So I said, don't worry, I call you later. I'm not going to make it to the fire. I'm just going to take them to a certain point and I'm coming down. But I cannot give them the key. So, hang up the phone. On the radio, I have my supervisor, Rodriguez, William Rodriguez, abandon the building right now. I continue. Since they stay there, I continue going floor by floor, opening, letting people out, until I stop on the 33rd floor. Why the 33rd floor? Because on the 33rd floor, I had a closet with all the supplies. Every 16th floor, I had a little cubicle to put stuff for the stairwells. And there I have like the paper mask that I use for the cleaning. So I wanted to give those paper masks to the people coming down the stairwell. Now, mind you, the people that is coming down, some of them are cut in their face because they're sitting in front of the offices with a window. Some of them are joking because they're nervous. But that hysterical thing that everybody talks about, that never happened. I guess everybody was in shock because nobody expected this. And we didn't know what was going on. So I continue going up and get to the 33rd floor. I find a lady trembling on the floor on a fetal position. She had no shoes. I said, what are you doing there? And she said, I don't know where to go. I stood her up, put her on the stairwell. There were a couple of people coming down. I remember people from the cafeteria of the 44th floor. And I say, take her out. And at that moment, on the corridor, I hear something very strange. On the 34th floor, I hear stuff being moved around. And heavy stuff. You know, like those metal dumpsters scratching the floor? Really heavy stuff. Now, why was it strange? Because the 34th floor was a floor that was got out by the construction crew of the World Trade Center, and it was closed. In other words, elevators did not stop there. There was no walls. There's nothing there. And for those people that, you know, maybe are not in construction, that's what a building does. When a tenant moves out, they got it out, and they make the money redesigning the place to the specification of the new tenant. So to hear this is the first time that I felt fear on that day. So, of course, I knew somebody was there. So I bypassed that floor and continued to the upper floors. People screaming. People, to this day, I guess the biggest pain and nightmare that I will have is just to hear the screams of people still stuck in the elevator. Claiming for help. So I make it to the 39th floor. On the 39th floor, from the opposite side of the stairwell, comes David Lim with two fire chiefs, because they have the white shirts, and we all gathered together to talk about what we were going to do next. And at that moment, bah! We hear the impact of the other tower, and inside of the building we hear boom, 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 boom. And on the radio we hear, we lost 65, we lost 65, meaning the 65th floor collapsed floor by floor by floor up to the 44th floor. We're on the 39th floor. Five flights away. And I go into a frenzy. We gotta go up. We gotta go up. We gotta go up. And David Lim said, Willie, no. You've done enough, but this is not your job. My mother again. And I say, what? No, I'm going up. He said, you're still a civilian, you're my responsibility. Better if you give me a hand with a person on the wheelchair on the 27th floor and get out. He said, you know, I'm going up. I said, please, Willie, just give me that, do me that favor. So I said, you know, I'm going to do it, but I'm coming right back. I ran down to the 27th floor. I screamed to the fireman and said, I have orders to get this guy down right now. The guy was already taken out from the wheelchair, put on a rescue basket, an orange basket, and tied up. And three firemen stood up, said, let's go. So we started bringing him down the stairwell. As we go down, we continue listening to small explosions in the building. And all of a sudden, chunks of the ceiling, of the wall, are coming all over us. But it was shiprock. And one of the things that I never forget, it was the building was shifting constantly. So the fluorescent light, the holders, changed position. And you could hear the lights breaking in line all the way down. Pa, 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 pa. So we're like, oh my God, what is this? All of a sudden we hear a huge thump. South Tower collapse. While we're going down the stairwell, we lost balance. We fell. I remember the guy on the rescue basket, because he had one of those masks, looked at us, and I said, don't worry. After this, we're going to go get a beer. And he looks at me and go like this. And I don't drink. I don't drink. We make it to the lobby. When we get to the lobby, that beautiful marble. How many people have ever been to the World Trade Center? Remember that marble that was on the lobby? Everything was pulled from the wall, and the only thing you saw was the cement patches where the marble was before. So I said, oh God, what is this? A Dantesque zine. I looked to the left. Everything was collapsed. The doors of the freight elevators and the passengers elevators on the lobby were open this way. Meaning something happened from the bottom and kicked the doors open from the bottom up like this. I said, again, God, what's going on? One of the firemen, his name was Regenhard, looks at me and said, set up the ambulance. So I turn to the right and goes to the West Side Avenue entrance, which was the main entrance to the building. As I go closer, every glass from the area was totally destroyed. There was glass shattered everywhere. Look to the left, the fire safety director area was totally collapsed. And I'm in shock again. I get to the front where the cubicle, not the cubicle, the revolving door was. There was no revolving door, just the empty space. I get to the front, and that's when I hear, don't look back, don't look back. It was the police. They had the area cordoned out, two blocks away, on the World Financial Center. And when I look, because that's the first thing a person will do when they tell you don't look back, I turn around. And I saw for the first time all the bodies of the people that jumped out of the building. And that lady from the 33rd floor that I just told her to get out, I found her cut in half because the glass came from the top of the building. And like a guillotine, cut her in half. So she never had a chance. And this is a fraction of a second. I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? What's going on? I look up, I see the half of the Marriott Hotel was gone. And there, all of a sudden, everything started trembling. And I hear the police saying, run, run, run. Now I'm in front of the building. I don't have anywhere to go. And the only thing I saw was a fire truck in front of the building. So I slid 12 feet away. I slid right under the fire truck. And as I put my leg in, the building started to collapse right on top of me. And you could hear the whole thing coming down. Boom, boom, boom. And the truck practically getting squashed. I was centimeters from the muffler. I could see the heat, the vapor and everything. And all I remember I said at that moment was, God, please don't give my mother the pain to see my body in pieces. Just let her find my body and recognize it. Because what I saw, all the bodies that I saw, and that's the only thing I asked for. And I knew I was going to die. And I expected death. And as I was there, all of a sudden, this dust came from every orifice under the truck and burns my face. Burn my leg on my thigh. I still have the scar. My knee was open. I don't know how. Totally open. And now I know I'm not dying squashed, but I'm going to die of asphyxia because I cannot breathe. And I put my face under I put my shirt right under, and I said, I'm going to die. I'm just going to wait death as much as I can. I was a magician for 30 years. And I used to do the escape tricks that every magician does, the straight jacket escape and everything. So, you know, we always thought that you have to relax, you have to contain your breathing, and that's what I was trying to do. Luckily, CNN and Globovision from Brazil were filming from the World Financial Center side, and they said the last person came out right there. And they pointed the area where the rescue effort started. And that's how I was saved that day. Now, they put me out in the middle of the road. That dust did not disperse for hours. That cloud. And I remember when they pulled me from under, the only thing I could see was the fluorescent lights on the jackets of the firemen. And a flashlight, and a guy screaming, this way, this way. And then I saw the word ambulance backwards. And I went in, stayed there for oxygen for like 15 minutes, came out, this is at the perimeter of Ground Zero. Get out, and the first thing I do is run back to where the truck was to make sure there was nobody else. When I get there, I was taken out on the nick of time because the tires blew up and the truck completely collapsed. So it was a mission. And I remember looking through the rubble. Remember that bridge that connected the World Financial Center with the World Trade Center? That collapsed on top of several fire trucks. I went under. I found two boots. I pulled the boots and I stayed with one leg inside. And that's when I said, I cannot continue doing this. But I stayed in the area until CNN called me, come over here. And I went over there and I thought, well, my mother probably thinks that I died. Somebody will be able to see me and let her know. So say I went over there and I told CNN, totally in shock. You know, I lost all my friends. The Port Authority police officer that was with me, they believe, died. Everybody died. The person on the wheelchair. The whole story, how I heard an explosion. How was explosions in the building. That went live on national TV all over the world. So what I'm telling you right now is nothing new. It's been out there. And after that, I became, of course, because of the media attention, I said, what I do with this? So I said, let's use it to organize the families. And that's why I started fighting for benefits and so on. Now, the good part was that, you see, these people, Felipe David, came out of coma 13 weeks after. Remember, I did not know these people personally. He sees me on NBC talking about the problems with the Red Cross, not giving money to the victims and so on. And he sees me and calls the doctor. He said, that's the guy that saved me. So NBC does a reunion on television, and it was very emotional. Felipe David, his testimony was never heard by the commission. And he was there. Salvatore Giambanco, that's TBN, the Christian Network, doing the encounter on Ground Zero. Sees me on TV, the same thing. That's the guy that saved me. Testimony never heard by the commission either. David Lim survived under the rubble. He was made sergeant after that. He lost his dog. And this is the encounter for Telemundo in New York. So my story started to be validated constantly within months by all these people that were there. And the reason we do this is that we need the truth. We need to find out. When you have Richard Clark coming on national TV and saying, we fail you. We lied to you. Our president failed you. Our government failed you. And you have Condoleezza Rice refusing to testify for the commission. It made it more important to find out the truth. And that's why we do this. We owe this to the victims. I lost 200 friends. 200 friends I never going to see again. You know the emotional inventory that you have to go daily. It's like your whole family is wiped out. So I have to be the voice for those people that don't have the opportunity to talk for themselves, to claim for justice. And that's why I'm going all over the world. Because if here they don't want to listen, they're listening out there. And they're doing the right thing out there. I want to thank all of you for this opportunity. All we ask is that continue asking questions. The families, the victims, and the survivors believe, and rightly so, because we have been through the whole process of the investigation, that we have been lied to, that they have used our tragedy for a political agenda that we do not agree with, that we have been used to lose our little civil rights that we have left. That movement from the 60s that fought so hard to give us rights is gone. The Patriot Act, one single act. This administration has taken all those rights like that. Congress, Senate, legislature, they're all into it. So we have to fight back. We have to get our rights back, because every time that something happens, when you are more passive and tranquil, you will hear on the news, red alert. Orange alert. They got to keep you constantly on secure. They have to control you. They have to control you. They put people on different television programs. Oh, it's okay that they check my bags and check my phone, and if I have nothing to hide and I'm going to feel more secure, I have to give my right to do that to feel more secure. It's okay. What? That doesn't make any sense. In conclusion, I want you to fight. I want you to take the motivation, the disposition, the enthusiasm to make a change and to ask the questions, not only about 9/11 like you do on everything else. Question everything. God bless you all.
That is the most amazingly powerful story, isn't it? I challenge anyone in the national media to try and dismiss 9/11 truth campaigners as conspiracy theorists. How can anyone who hears that not be moved and not want to at least look at what's been said officially in the media?
I want to invite everybody to go to 911truthcampaign.net to get all the information about what really happened on that day. Also, you can go to 911, the number is 911, keymaster.com, and that's my personal website, and they can get that audio and the video as well of the presentation. So you can educate yourself and use this information to actually make a change in your community. This change can be actually achieved very easily if everybody do something about it. Some people say, I don't know what to do. How am I going to go about it? So, well, you can donate. You can donate your time, your skills maybe. Maybe support the person that is fighting for it, because some people cannot do it. So then, you know, you have activists, and we are your activists. We are the ones making the change for you. So we need to continue doing this, and the only way we can do it is with your support, either emotionally, either economically, or either for you to do the simple things, because we need volunteers. So let's do it. Let's do it together. I think we can make a change and make this better. Don't let this event be repeated in your own soil.
That is very, very moving and very true. I mean, we have to mobilize around this. Otherwise, we're just going to lose the democracies that we have, the democracies that we take for granted. I mean, do we want to be the people who say to our grandchildren that we're the ones who threw away the freedoms and you're now working as economic slaves? We can't allow this to happen.
And what will our children say 20 years from now? 20 years from now? Mm. What did you do at that time? Why didn't you open your mouth? Look what I'm living through now. You know, let's be proud of what we do, and let's make a change. We can do it. We really can do it.
Mm. And it's not just necessarily actually having to go out and pound the streets. This isn't old-fashioned activism necessarily. Is
correct.
It? It's about just opening your mind, doing your own research, informing yourself, raising awareness.
Correct.
And then talking to other people, talking to your immediate family, your friends and circles, and then talking to people you work with and the wider community, just getting people to think. Because I think the politicians love the fact that great swathes of us are turned off by mainstream politics, that we can't be bothered to go out and vote, that
correct.
We don't see the point. They love that. You know, we have to really think about what being a member of society is, what our democratic rights and our democratic responsibilities are. And I think at the moment we have those responsibilities to fight for it.
And this is growing very, very fast, not only here but all over the world.
Mm.
I've been meeting with groups from every country that I have visited. I've been in Paris, Madrid. Madrid especially was amazing. Remember, Madrid had the Madrid bombings in 6/11. So you have such amount of people trying, I'm sorry, 3/11, trying to get to the truth of their own false flags. Remember that they wanted to take Madrid and say that it was ETA, which was the vast movement, and they tried to blame them. The government over there even sent facts to every embassy of Spain all over the world to say officially that it was ETA. And then when a radio station, one single small radio station, came out and said that the whole thing was a lie and they had the way to prove it, the whole government crumbled, and the population stood up and angrily voted the whole government out. So it was historical by itself, the biggest upset ever seen in history. But they tried to pull a 9/11 and it failed.
So is there a very strong 3/11 truth movement over there, or are they focusing on 9/11 as the key to the whole thing?
It's the key to the whole thing.
Of course.
I was just wondering if with the Kennedy assassination and also with the Oklahoma bombing, the information behind that is actually all out there behind who actually did both of those things, and yet still we have to live in this kind of uncertainty as if nobody knows who really did it. But the information exists.
It exists, and the best part is that during the Kennedy assassination, we did not have the internet, we did not have the information superhighway, and this is something that really scared any government. For any part of the world to have access, instant access, to so much information is really scary because they cannot control us.
The irony being, of course, it was the Pentagon that developed the internet. It's fantastic. They've shot themselves in the foot. I mean, just going back to one thing Marion just mentioned, I mean, the whole idea of the Oklahoma bombing. You said in Spain, of course, they tried to blame ESA. In Oklahoma, they tried to blame Al-Qaeda.
Correct. And not only that, I have one of the reports and the families of Oklahoma also feel that the whole thing has not been told, and up to date, I mean, it's already 9 years after Oklahoma, we know that they have lied to them as well, and I have actual victims, leaders on tape, on video, saying that the whole thing also was a whitewash. So, you know, it's ridiculous what we're going through at this point in terms of tragedies, human tragedy, and try to get to that information. It's just ridiculous.
I mean, one thing I find really frustrating, because, I mean, of course, I've been dealing with journalists for years now on Dave's case, is their sort of patronizing dismissal. Oh, well, these people are grieving. They will look for any answers. They don't trust their government. It's some sort of psychological malaise, almost. They try and brush it off as to say we're all conspiracy theorists. It's not that.
No. It's when they tell me that, I say, hold on, excuse me. I am a survivor. I am a link between the families and the last moment to their loved ones. I am a person that was there and I experienced the events. My testimony is being used in court effectively. My testimony was one of the 30 testimonies that was going to be used against Zacharias Moussaoui. And I have to recourse myself because they wanted the death penalty. I say, how would it look to the world and to me that I saved hundreds of people and now I'm asking for the death penalty of somebody that I don't even know if he's guilty? You know, it's ridiculous. And so what you have here is, you know, I don't know if it has happened to you. You mentioned the media, that, you know, how many times the media went to your place and recorded you for many hours, and they did this whole great interview, and you expected it to be on TV on specific day, and then you waited, and they didn't even show a second of it. How many times did that happen to you?
Very frequently. Over a period of 10 years since Dave and I left MI5, blew the whistle, this is precisely what they do. They want to find out what you know. They're desperate to do that. They also want to sort of asset strip you for information as well, because it makes their careers, and then leave you in the lurch. I mean, they are sharks. I always call the whole process swimming with sharks, really. I mean, of course, there are exceptions that prove the rule. There are some very honourable journalists out there. But the great swathe of them just want to take advantage of whistleblowers and leave them high and dry. I mean, Dave went to trial, at the end of his court case, after the jury had been ordered to convict him, which is in fact what happened, breaching all normal legal process in this country, the judge gave his formal ruling, and he said, well, of course, you know, I accept David Shaler did what he did in the public interest, I accept there was no venal motive, and I accept that nobody's lives were put at risk.
And not only that, when David has to basically defend himself, he didn't have access to interrogate the witnesses. I mean, it's ridiculous.
When he wanted to ask them the questions, the judge and the prosecution vetted his questions. So you're in a case where The person can't defend themselves in court. They can't say why they did what they did. They can't make any form of cogent cross-examination to establish the reliability of that witness. And then the judge says, well, this is the facts of the case as I see it, restricted as they were. The journalists were sitting about 10 feet opposite from me, writing it all down in their shorthand. And I thought, well, at least, you know, this will reflect what's actually happened in his case. But the next day, the headline said, Shayla sells agent lives down the river for money.
Oh, my God.
It was the exact opposite. I mean, you know, are these guys just bad at shorthand or what? You know, and quite a lot of them as well had used him for stories, had used him to help their careers. And then they were quite happy to see him go off to Belmarsh High Security Prison. And that's the media, most of them. I mean, some of them are lovely. I mean, you know, I'm not pretending.
Well, I have a famous television network in New York spending the whole day and recording me for 8 hours, and I never saw a second on TV. And then when I realized what it was, somebody from NSA, National Security Agency, retired agent, said, hello, wake up, stupid. They just debrief you.
Mm.
They have all your information already on videotape, and they know exactly where you're standing, and they wanted to check if you have any new information that they probably didn't have. So they just debrief you completely. 8 hours in your house. Way, man. You have a lot to learn about this media connected with the government.
Yeah,
and I was very surprised.
Steep learning process. Especially when they come into your own home and do that to you.
Yes. Horrible. And especially when they go to your house. As a matter of fact, I was married years before 9/11 and divorced. And I have one of my rings there, and it was stolen by one of those crew.
Yes. So, on a slightly more optimistic note, what's the immediate future? Where are you going? What are you going to be doing?
The future is I will be going back to New York tomorrow. I will be doing the 9/11 Health Conference Part 2 in New York City, presenting all these health issues of the people that are dying because of the exposure to the collapse of the building. Then I will be going to Penang, Malaysia, on the 25th of December up to the 1st of January. Then I have something pending to go to Venezuela, and I don't know how long that will be for, but it's just to organize an international inquiry about what happened on 9/11, and then I will be coming back to UK, and I'm trying to set up the time now with the 9/11 Truth Campaign .net group here in UK to be able to do a tour all over England, so people will hear firsthand the information, the evidence, and what really happened on that day.
Well, I look forward to it. I think that's going to be an amazing tour. I mean, looking at the success of the last week.
I believe so. And I really think that, you know, I love meeting with people. I love having the opportunity on a face-to-face basis to change, exchange ideas, and at the same time experiences. And I tell you, this has been a very, very productive visit, and I believe we can do much more. But again, like I said before, we need the people's support. We need them to educate themselves. I want them to, one way or the other, do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's don't trust the government. Don't necessarily trust us. Go and find out for yourself.
Find out for yourself.
That's the message
for tonight. That is correct.
So when you're in Venezuela, are you actually going to meet Hugo Chavez and get this inquiry up and running, do you think?
We're working on it, yes, definitely.
Fantastic. Because, I mean, of course, he's come out in public and said, you know, it's not as it appears to be. And
I've been involved in that, and I just don't want to say too much because I don't think the people in my country will like that.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for extending your stay in the UK.
Thank you. And again, you know, people wants to learn a little bit about me, they can go to 911, the numbers 911, keymaster.com. And if they want to get in contact with me, they want to send me an email or anything, they can do it through that website, or they can do it through your website as well. So please be welcome to write anything or to send us your comments, and I'd be glad to actually answer all of them. So
if you ever get the chance, you're inundated, aren't you? People around the globe are trying to contact.
Well, how many emails did I show you today?
Ooh, well over 13,000.
Yes.
That was just in 1 week?
In 1 week.
Incredible. I mean, this is the scale of interest, the scale of concern that we're talking about. And this is just one activist getting inundated. I mean, this is just amazing.
Really. And if I, as a janitor, have been able to do so many changes, and I was just a caretaker, think about it. You have so many people out there prepared with a college degree that can do so much more. You just need the passion, the disposition to actually say, I want to change the situation. And you can do it. You really can do it.
Well, this is it. I mean, 9/11 is an empowering issue. It's not about, oh, my God, there's all these evil people out there. I can do nothing. It's educate yourself, educate your friends and family, get out there and get active and take back the power from them. You know, we are supposed to live in a democracy. We have the power, not the government. Anyway, on that note, thank you ever so much for coming in. It's been a most amazing tour. And this is Annie Mashon signing off from The David Chalier Show. Thank you very much. Good night.